nuclear deal. Iran has the right to retaliate for the illegal murder of Fakhrizadeh and the 3rd of January 2020 assassination of top general Qasem Soleimani, an act which only resulted in heavy losses for the United States, the losses which it took to its bases in Iraq, completely sabotaging the reoccupation campaign undertaken post-2013 following the 2011 U.S. withdrawal. Cyber attacks on Iran's centrifuges only gave Tehran the chance to replace those that needed updating anyway, as well as strengthening their security. Though the Zionist entity, working through the IAEA, the European Union, and the United States, has not been held accountable for its actions diplomatically, it and its allies have suffered a bigger loss with each successive plot. The endless scheming has failed to position both Israel and its allies as being the best, or at least better, planners. As of late, it's questionable how unbreakable the bond really is between the United States and the Israeli regime, following the latest fallout from the nuclear deal. Yes, the United States House Committee passed the Stop Iran Drones Act on 12th of December, comically adding more sanctions during rounds of a negotiating process which is meant to remove illegal sanctions in the first place. The Israelis also attempted to resort again to contacting European and American intelligence to push the claim that Iran was enriching uranium at weapons-grade degree of purity. In an unusual move, the U.S. declined Israeli requests for tanker aircraft as the Zionist regime pushed to fast-track an attack on Iran. In a Friday, 10th of December interview, Donald Trump angrily said that if it weren't for his compliance in withdrawing from the JCPOA in 2018, Israel would have been destroyed by now. The latest domestic dispute in the House of Empire didn't occur primarily over Netanyahu's eager congratulations of Biden in a partisan sense, as various media sources have emphasized, but rather another indication of the increasing contradictions and mistrust between the allies, whose reputed inseparability is increasingly marred by losing their political grip and grounding domestically and on the world stage. Reports in Zionist regime media, too, have revealed anxieties of its ability to effectively control Washington amid brewing distrust. The United States has more to gain from a fair deal than no deal at all, and Tel Aviv fears that Washington would resort to opening communication lines with Iran without the Zionist regime's knowledge, with a precedent in history. Yet, not a likely outcome because of the deep entrenchment of Zionist lobbyists in Washington politics. Meanwhile, Iran, the honest party under a deal that was designed to stack all the odds against it, has emerged the victor in the Battle of Vienna talks' latest round, and ultimately the overall winner of the war. Iran is in a position and certainly has the right to make more solid demands in light of its opponent's shady ground. Any false claims that talks have been stalled are weak attempts to obscure that. In reality, more diplomatic progress and political clarity has been attained in the last two rounds of talks at Vienna than in the previous 6 years of the nuclear deals process. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, wasn't a fair fight, but Iran clearly beat the United States at its own game.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and especially the people. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we shall discuss the breach of religious freedom in Indian-controlled Kashmir, vis-a-vis the closure of the region's central mosque and a ban on Muharram processions. And we will look at the recent civilian killings in the northeastern Indian state of Nagaland and why calls are growing louder for the repeal of a controversial law.
The recent civilian killings in India's Nagaland state have reignited the long-running debate over a controversial law that confers armed forces with unbridled powers, prompting the Provincial Legislative Assembly to unanimously pass a resolution calling for its abrogation. The trigger was the killing of six coal mine workers early this month in a botched counter-insurgency operation. In the ensuing clashes, seven more civilians were killed. The incidents sparked widespread protests in Nagaland and fueled calls for the repeal of the law.
On the fateful evening of December the 4th, Indian Army soldiers opened fire at a pickup truck carrying coal miners in Nagaland's Mon district. Six civilians were killed on the spot. Later that day, seven more civilians and a soldier died in clashes between people and police. On December the 5th, one more civilian was shot dead when angry protesters ambushed an army camp. Army soldiers had apparently mistaken the group of coal miners for insurgents. India's Home Minister Amit Shah said the government regretted what he called the unfortunate incident, describing civilian killings as the case of mistaken identity. In the days after Shah's statement, angry protesters filled the streets across Nagaland and adjoining states, demanding the minister's apology and, more importantly, calling for the repeal of Armed Forces Special Powers Act, a draconian law that provides grounds for men in uniform in India's so-called disturbed areas to commit horrendous human rights abuses. On December the 20th, the Nagaland State Assembly unanimously passed a resolution demanding that the BJP government at centre repeal the controversial and much-abused law from the state and from the rest of the northeast. It also demanded that the appropriate authority issue an apology for the massacre and that justice be delivered to the perpetrators.
It's not the first instance that the Armed Forces Special Powers Act has hogged headlines for the wrong reasons. The controversial law, enacted in 1958 to maintain control and curb insurgency in what the Indian government considered disturbed areas, is enforced in at least five Indian states. The legislation has drawn flak from national and international human rights watchdogs as it gives unbridled powers and immunity to the armed personnel to shoot, kill, make arrests on flimsy pretexts, conduct searches without warrant, and demolish structures.
The controversial law, also known as AFSPA, was first enacted in 1958 to allow deployment of armed forces to counter a secessionist movement in the hills of Nagaland. Six decades later, it is in force in Manipur, Assam, parts of Arunachal Pradesh, and in the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir, the places labeled as disturbed areas. The legislation gives license to Indian Army soldiers to carry out excesses without fear of legal prosecution, even when they kill and injure people, raid houses without warrant, or use deadly and indiscriminate force on mere suspicion, like the case of Nagaland killings. The law has long shielded Indian soldiers stationed in the so-called disturbed areas from accountability for grave human rights abuses and has denied justice to the affected families. A 2019 report on Jammu and Kashmir by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said the law remains a key obstacle to accountability. Following the latest incident in Nagaland, which has shaken the conscience of the nation of 1.3 billion people, calls for repealing the law have grown louder in all northeastern states. But will the BJP government in New Delhi move to abolish it? No one is quite ready to bet on that.
Now, Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Kalol Bhattacharjee, Senior Assistant Editor with the Hindu newspaper. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Bhattacharjee. Let's begin with the recent civilian killings in northeast India's Nagaland state, which have reignited the long-running debate about the use and abuse of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. Now, can you tell us what exactly happened in Nagaland?
Hello, thank you so much for inviting me to this bulletin and this discussion on the developments regarding AFSPA or AFSPA, as we call it in India. What happened that evening in Nagaland is that a group of daily wage workers were returning home from their work in a nearby mine. And while they were returning, they were ambushed by a group of Indian soldiers who also were reportedly working on solid intelligence inputs that a group of insurgents were waiting to carry out an attack on the Indian soldiers. So the report that came later on to us is that these soldiers were targeted by these reported insurgents, and therefore this ambush was carried out in a defensive way so that insurgents could be neutralized. However, later on we heard that the issue was of mistaken identity, as it was claimed by the Indian Home Minister in the Parliament, and that the soldiers felt that they were going to be ambushed by a group of insurgents, and therefore they acted in self-defense. But very soon we got to know that the local villagers were the first to arrive at the scene, and they discovered that the bodies of those people who had been shot dead were being loaded onto a jeep or some other vehicles that the army soldiers were driving around in. So the local villagers came, and then they attacked the Indian soldiers, and which really led to a massive mayhem at that point. And that was the main reason that an Indian soldier also lost his life. It was, in brief, the entire sequence of events.
So, Mr. Bhattacharjee, this much abused law grants the Indian Army unbridled powers to maintain public order in so-called disturbed areas. Now, do you think this is a smokescreen to escape accountability for human rights abuses?
I would also like to mention that this particular area of Nagaland is very close to the international border with Myanmar. And also please remember that the crisis in Myanmar has been escalating over the last 8 months or so. And the international community has not really acted in a collective manner to ensure any sort of pressure on the Myanmarese junta. What's happening as a result is that there is a spillover effect on the nearby areas, especially on India's northeastern areas, where a lot of the smuggling activities have heightened, because the Myanmar rulers themselves are involved in drugs and other sorts of smuggling activities. And what's of great concern is that apart from the exodus of people from Myanmar, there is also this influx of these goods and items and drugs into India's border areas and also into Bangladesh. So this has also heightened tension among the heightened tension as well as distrust among the armed forces or the law enforcement agencies, as well as the locals and those people who are involved in those sort of activities, illicit activities. So this basically, in the context of this particular development in India's neighboring Myanmar, what's happening is that this kind of a law, that is a law like AFSPA, has more chances of getting abused, because if there is faulty information or intelligence about a certain movement of drugs or movement of insurgents, then these sort of laws actually increase the chances of such incidents being repeated in future as well.
Like you've mentioned, there have been numerous protests in northeastern Indian states as well as in Jammu and Kashmir against this law over the years. Now, how do Indian authorities justify its continued use?
Well, as you understand, the situation in Kashmir has been problematic for a very long time because of India's position, as well as because of Pakistan's perceived interference. What happens in Kashmir is that the law and order situation on the ground is always very fragile because of cross-border attempts from the Pakistani side to keep the pot boiling in Kashmir, and on the ground level you have a big presence of the ultras or the other, you know, insurgents from the other side are always present in some numbers. So that is one issue which the Indian state has often cited as one of the main reasons why it has kept AFSPA in Kashmir. And that is often the only answer that we have received from the Indian state or whenever the extra-legal developments have taken place in Kashmir. Having said that, I must say that that is not the only legal instrument in the hands of the Indian state as far as Kashmir is concerned, because the region is highly militarized. And in that context, not a very normal governance process can't really function. And therefore, the Kashmiri situation is very unique. And the Indian state has often cited that as one of the main reasons that enabled its use of AFSPA on the ground in Kashmir.
Before we let you go, sir, one last question. Why has there been no international outcry over the Indian government's use of the controversial law?
Well, there has not been any international outcry on the AFSPA, primarily because India prides itself on its democratic credentials. But also please remember that after this particular incident took place in Nagaland, whether we call it an outcry or not, the issue of AFSPA or the abuse of such extra-legal matters laws by the enforcement agencies or the Indian Armed Forces has been taken up by the UN Human Rights Council.
Mr. Bhattacharjee, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Senior Indian journalist Supriya Sharma says the families of civilians killed by the Indian Army in Nagaland have refused government compensation until the culprits are punished and the controversial law is repealed. Conrad Sangma, the Chief Minister of Northeastern Indian State of Meghalaya, extends his support to protesters in Nagaland in their demand to have AFSPA repealed from the Northeast. A legislator from northwestern Gujarat state, Jignesh Mevani, says the Nagaland killings should force authorities to rethink and review the draconian law so that accountability can be fixed.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
The centuries-old central mosque in the summer capital of Indian-controlled Kashmir has remained largely locked for the past 2 years since the abrogation of the region's special status sparked unrest. Built in the 15th century, the mosque is seen by Indian authorities as a trouble spot. It's a place where Kashmiri Muslims gather to offer Friday prayers and to raise voice for their legitimate political aspirations. They see its closure as denial of their right to religious freedom.
The closure of the Himalayan region's 600-year-old central mosque known as Jamia Masjid and denial of permission to Kashmiri Muslims to hold the congressional Friday prayers for the past 2 years has deepened anger and resentment among them. The mosque was shut down immediately after the Narendra Modi-led BJP government in New Delhi stripped Indian-controlled Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status. In the past 2 years, which have been marked by intermittent protests and shutdowns, the historic mosque has remained out of bounds to worshippers on Fridays, even though authorities allow it to remain open on other days. Jamia Masjid has played a key role in the region's turbulent history. It has traditionally been the bastion of resistance against Kashmir's autocratic rulers. In 1819, Sikh rulers had closed it for 21 years. During the rule of Dogra Hindu dynasty between 1846 and 1947, the mosque often remained shut. In the past 30 years, since the anti-India resistance gained momentum in Kashmir, Jamia Masjid has been subject to periodic bans and lockdowns by successive Indian governments. The chief priest of the mosque and senior pro-freedom leader, Mirwaz Umar Farooq, has often delivered fiery political speeches from the mosque's pulpit, highlighting the political struggle of Kashmiris. Interestingly, in the year 1980, during his visit to Kashmir, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had also delivered a historic sermon at the mosque, which focused on Shia-Sunni unity.
While the Indian government, as part of sweeping measures to crush political dissent, has imposed a tougher security clampdown in Indian-controlled Kashmir since October 2019, infringement of religious freedom has been a long-lasting phenomenon in the disputed region. Besides closing mosques and putting religious leaders and clerics under house arrest, there is a long-running ban on the historic Muharram 10 procession in Srinagar city, which Kashmiri Muslims see as a blatant breach of their religious freedom.
Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to the early 16th century, when both Shia and Sunni Muslims would come together to parade the streets on the day of Ashura. The processions were banned during the rule of Afghans, followed by Mughals, Sikhs and Dogras, who had a hostile attitude towards Shias. However, in the latter part of the Dogra rule in the late 19th century, the tradition was revived with the cooperation of both the communities. In 1989, when armed resistance against the Indian rule began in Kashmir, the government of India moved swiftly to impose a ban on the procession as part of sweeping measures to deal with the political unrest. Almost 33 years later, the ban remains in place. Each year, police impose curfew-like restrictions on Muharram 8th and 10th in the heart of Srinagar city to foil the Muharram processions. And each year, thousands of mourners defy the ban and carry out peaceful processions while being subjected to brutal police action. Mourners are intercepted by heavily armed police and paramilitary personnel who fire tear smoke canisters and resort to baton charge. Last year, dozens of them were arrested who spent months in jail. Despite repeated pleas, the successive Indian governments have refused to lift the illegal ban.
Now, to have more insight, I would like to welcome Mr. Zamir Ahmed Awan to the program. He is an ex-diplomat and political analyst. Mr. Awan, the centuries-old Grand Mosque of Kashmir has remained closed for the past 2 years. Why is the historic mosque seen as a trouble spot by Indian authorities?
Thank you very much for inviting me to give my comments. It is a symbolic mosque. It belongs to the Islamic history and represents the Muslim community in the Kashmir. Historically, India was ruled by the Muslim for almost 800 years, and there was a complete harmony between the Muslims and the other religions in India under the Islamic rule. Since the India got independence in 1947, for almost seven decades, Muslims and other minorities in India were living almost peacefully. But since the BJP government took power under the leadership of Narendra Modi, the extremist wings like RSS are promoting hate against the minorities, especially against the Muslims. And they have agenda to purify the India as a pure Indian state without any other religion. So they are also harming other religion in addition to the Muslim, like Christian, Sikhs, and Buddhists, and all other religion. Especially in the Kashmir, where the Muslims are in the majority, they are more harming the Muslims. And this mosque has historical importance. That's why they have closed for the almost couple of years.
Mr. Awan, the Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi has taken many controversial measures since October 2019. Now, do you see the closure of the mosque as part of a plan to deny Kashmiris their religious freedom?
You are absolutely right. Since 2019, Narendra Modi, when won the election, his slogan was to convert the India into a pure Hindu state, and he has got the support from all the extremist Hindu groups like RSS. And as per his agenda, as per his promise in the election, he have to take severe and extremist measures against the minorities, not only against the Muslim but also against the Christian and other religions also, like amended Citizen Act, canceling the constitution and occupying the occupied Kashmir, and also many other measures which are extremist, and that is the part of their political plan, and they might do something more harmful to the Muslims.
So for Muslims in Kashmir, the mosque closure also brings painful memories from the past. Why has this mosque always been at the center of political storm?
Always the center point for the political activities in Kashmir. The Muslim freedom movement in Kashmir is always having meetings there and gathering there, and a lot of protest against the Indian government was originated from this mosque. And in past also the Indian security forces has sealed it and closed it for many times, but recently they have taken various prolonged action to close down this mosque. I think it is political motivated and ill planned.
Mr. Awan, the Indian government has also not allowed the historic Muharram procession to take place in the Srinagar city for the past 3 decades. Now, why is it afraid of peaceful religious practices of Kashmiri Muslims?
In fact, the Indian government is suppressing the Muslims and not allowing them to perform their religious duties. The procession of Muharram is a ritual and has been performing for many centuries peacefully, but Indian government is afraid when the Muslims are gathered, they might protest against the government, or they might make some slogans against the government. So in preventing such a situation, they have not allowed the Muharram procession for several years. In fact, not only the Muharram procession, but also other religious activities also are banned.
Mr. Awan, while Muslims are barred from exercising their right to religious freedom, Hindus are allowed to perform their religious rites, even publicly. Now, do these double standards point to something deeply sinister?
In India, there are many other religions and minorities. The dominating is the Brahmin, which are only 8% of the whole population. But they are in power, they are in the government, they are in the bureaucracy, they are in the security forces, they are in the police, they are in the district management, and they are controlling all these things, and they are suppressing the Muslims, especially in the Kashmir, where Muslims are in the majority.
Mr. Awan, thank you for being on the program. Love to talk to you again. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Zubair Amin, a Kashmir-based independent journalist, notes that Kashmiri Muslims have long accused New Delhi of curbing their religious freedom on the pretext of law and order, while promoting and patronizing the annual Hindu pilgrimage. Multimedia journalist from Kashmir, Mukhtar Zahur, pictures a man who traveled 40 kilometers to offer Friday prayers at Kashmir's central mosque, only to realize that it has been shut. Masroor Ansari, a senior Kashmiri pro-freedom leader, slams the Kashmir police for brutal use of force to thwart a peaceful Muharram procession in Srinagar recently.
And that was our episode about the growing calls in India for the repeal of a controversial law in the wake of the recent civilian killings in Nagaland state, and also the denial of religious freedom to Kashmiri Muslims by the Indian government. Take care.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Prior to the 2021 presidential election, mainstream media kept warning about the rise of so-called hardliners in Iran, which they claimed would steer the Islamic Republic away from diplomacy. The article you're about to hear has been written by Elham Abedini, a PhD student in European Studies. The piece is titled Iran's Active Diplomacy and West's Ticking Clock on JCPOA. Prior to the 2021 presidential election, mainstream media kept warning about the rise of so-called hardliners in Iran, which they claimed would steer the Islamic Republic away from diplomacy. Indeed, what happened in reality was the exact opposite. President Ebrahim Raisi, on his maiden foreign trip, attended the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit, and with a unanimous decision, Iran became a full member of the Eurasian Alliance. What ensued was a rising number of meetings and exchanges between Iranians and foreign officials. Most notably, Iran signed a trilateral deal with neighbors, the Republic of Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan, to facilitate the transfer of gas. Tehran also took the initiative as talks resumed in Vienna on the revival of the 2015 nuclear agreement, which has been in trouble because of America's unilateral exit and imposition of sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In Vienna, Iran put two proposals on the negotiating table, aimed at helping the diplomatic process move forward. One, on the removal of U.S. sanctions, and the other, concerning Iran's commitments under the agreement. The notably large delegation that Iran sent to Vienna, including economic experts, showed Iran had returned to the talks with a firm resolve and wanted to achieve a good deal, which would bring no more than the commitments stipulated in the 2015 deal and no less than the removal of all sanctions that Washington imposed on Iran in violation of the accord after its withdrawal from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. In fact, Iran's legitimate demands have been precise. The country wants to reap the economic benefits of the JCPOA, something that never happened, not even under ex-President Barack Obama, whose administration inked the agreement. Donald Trump unilaterally left the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2018 and imposed a series of sanctions against Iran under his so-called maximum pressure campaign. Although his successor Joe Biden stressed the importance of the Iran nuclear deal during his election campaigning and criticized Donald Trump for pulling the U.S. out of the deal, Biden has so far been dragging his feet on a return to the JCPOA, despite rejoining several other international deals that his predecessor had left during his four-year term in office. While Iran has been showing seriousness and firm determination to achieve a diplomatic solution, besides expressing full preparedness for result-orientated dialogue, the United States is still trying to portray itself as the party that has the right to make even more demands. This is while Washington is no longer a party to the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and is not allowed to directly join the Vienna talks due to its unilateral exit from the agreement. Iran will automatically benefit from the JCPOA if the agreement actually brings about a removal of the sanctions. The United States needs the JCPOA as well, although it has been trying to conceal it. Iran has repeatedly emphasized that it will not negotiate for the sake of negotiations and will not accept protracted negotiations. It is therefore clear that Iran is not wasting time and is seeking a quick, good deal. Still, the West sets artificial deadlines for the Islamic Republic. Now that the maximum pressure campaign is at its peak and the United States is left with no more sanctions to impose on Iran, it is in fact the Western side, and not Tehran, that is facing a deadline, since Iran keeps enhancing its nuclear industry on a daily basis, much to the West's dismay. On the other hand, the Biden administration, which is weak and has lost its popularity due to the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, currently needs a foreign policy achievement to avoid an election defeat in 2024 against his Republican rival. The interesting thing is that a propaganda campaign launched by the mainstream media against Iran was in full swing even before the Raisi administration took office and reaffirmed its serious resolve for active diplomacy and dialogue. Even after Iran put forward the two proposals in Vienna, the Western governments called Tehran's demands unrealistic and inconsistent with the JCPOA. In the United States, some special interest groups and lobbyists have been trying to persuade Joe Biden to return to the JCPOA and advertise it as a diplomatic achievement, turning a blind eye to Washington's earlier violations of international law. Although Western media and lobby groups are trying to change the narrative and show the reality upside down, they will not be able to change the truth or hide the realities for any length of time.
Situated in a relatively remote desert at the Negev Nuclear Research Center, the Dimona reactor is a heavy water-moderated natural uranium-fueled reactor. Most independent analysts believe that in the mid-1970s, Israel upgraded the installation to generate between 70 and 150 megawatts. Now that output makes it not only the region's largest reactor, the sole evident producer of plutonium and tritium from nuclear weapons. And although Israel neither confirms nor denies its atomic arsenal, experts believe that it's been a nuclear-armed regime now for several decades. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. While the Zionist regime of Israel has maintained its decades-long policy of deliberate ambiguity about its weapons of mass destruction, its deadly arsenal is not the only danger threatening lives. The very existence of the Dimona is a terror haunting Jordan and Israel's other neighboring countries. A higher rate of cancer and the constant fear of possible malfunctions at the reactor are some of the worries that locals must deal with on a daily basis. And the Israelis are aware of the possibility of a meltdown at the Dimona reactor, a meltdown that would affect an area reaching Cyprus and the entire neighboring region. What makes these concerns even more pressing are satellite images of the Dimona reactor, which show that its walls have cracks which could cut its life by half. Join us this week's documentary exploring the threats that Dimona is posing on its neighbors.
nobody knows.
You see, I blush. You say Dimona and I blush. We're not supposed to talk about Dimona. But
why?
Go ahead. Because it's a taboo. It's a taboo. It's a secret.
Negev Desert, south of Israel. This mysterious complex, away from the public eye, employs thousands of people, all sworn to secrecy. When its existence was discovered, Israel said it was a textile factory, never admitting its true purpose, making plutonium for atomic bombs. We need answers, and we go to meet one of the few people in Israel that knows what is going on inside Dimona.
We are dealing with disarmament of the weapons of mass destruction, meaning nuclear, chemical, and biological. We're the only NGO dealing with this right now in Israel. When you believe that these are the weapons that keeps you safe, when this is the common belief, then the question raised, are we the next country to use them? Israel is a nuclear armed state, chemical armed state, and biological armed state. Nuclear weapon is not a weapon that aimed at an army. It's a weapon that destroys a city. Are we willing to destroy any city in the Middle East? Mothers, children, fathers, citizens, not soldiers.
We want to know more about the most secretive nuclear program in the world. Is the Israeli nuclear plant at Dimona poisoning and threatening the lives of millions throughout the Middle East? From Tel Aviv, we go south. Our destination, Dimona. Approaching the nuclear plant is a high risk. The highway splices through the heat and sand of the Negev Desert. Barbed wire fence edges the road. Signs posted every few hundred meters warn drivers not to stop their vehicles under any circumstances.
They have cameras, they will see.
This is a military zone.
They said don't go off the road because we can shoot your ass. Military zone, no photography.
Finally, we can have a distant look at one of the world's most secret facilities. An exclusive view of a secret Israel is hiding since the 1960s. Dimona nuclear plant.
That's the gate. Go inside.
Only a few people in the world can say they know each corner of Dimona nuclear plant. All of them are sworn to secrecy. But there is someone that knows exactly how the building looks like.
There was a secret competition with the design of the civic center of a new atomic research center that was to be built in Dimona, in the south part of Israel. For security reasons, we couldn't call it a big center of research, what it was called, civic center in the Negev. In the 60s, it wasn't such big news to have a textile factory in Dimona. So if you build something large in Dimona, you could very easily say, see, this is a textile factory. Only that this textile factory had a dome and very... wasn't typical of textile things, but it wasn't seen from the road. It was kind of an agreed quietness. I have the photograph. While the project was being built, not when it was occupied. Then at that time, the security eye was not that strong. So I took the photographs. Later, many years afterwards, I all of a sudden got several photos from an unknown source, but with a stamp of the censorship. So I understood that somebody from the site sent me photos that were taken there. There's a sign that I can open my small portfolio and make it public. The courtyard of the main building, from the other side, looking towards the entrance. The detail of the stairs leading from the to the roof. You can have a roof cover, as you see here. You can go up to the roof undercover. There's a kind of.
This message is transmitted by Radio Free Brooklyn.
When President Kennedy took office, he knew from a CIA secret report that Israel was developing a nuclear program in the Negev. At the beginning of January 1961, Kennedy met the Israeli ambassador in Washington and expressed that the USA wanted to inspect Dimona to be sure about its purposes. Israel accepted, but under one condition, if it was done on a secret basis. For 5 months, the visit of the American inspectors to Dimona nuclear plant was postponed several times by Israel. Finally, an ultimatum from USA was accepted. Two American scientists were allowed to visit Dimona in May 1961. Israel imposed several rules on the American inspectors. They were not allowed to take any pictures or issue any comments about Dimona. When the inspectors finally entered the plant, they were misled. They were shown a fake control room on the ground floor. 12th of January 1961, the aim of the building built in the Negev was clear. In a high-level meeting between President Eisenhower and his staff, the U.S. Secretary of Defense informs the president that based on intelligence findings, Israel was lying and Dimona was not for peaceful purposes. They were unaware of the 6 floors below where the plutonium was made. In search of answers, we travelled to Berlin in Germany. Here we are going to meet Xanthe Hall. She is an expert in nuclear weapons and the director of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Xanthe Hall is also the coordinator of the European Parliament Commission against Nuclear Proliferation.
The Israel Atomic Energy Commission is one of the most secret institutions in the world. It's responsible for Dimona. Its chairman is Netanyahu, but it's not even officially recognized as existing. All the other nuclear plants in the world are monitored by the Atomic Energy Agency, but not the ones in Israel. So we think it's about time that Dimona was also monitored. The one thing that needs to happen is that an independent body like the IAEA would go into Dimona and find out what is going on there, what is the state of the substance of the building, is the containment of the nuclear reactor still intact? What are they doing about cooling? Where is the nuclear waste being stored? How is it being stored? And all these questions, they need to be answered. We need some transparency.
Israel has not ratified the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Way of avoiding inspections to its nuclear sites.
First of all, we are not obliged
We are not part of the treaties. We never signed the treaties, so we don't oblige. We never said we won't. That's one thing. Second thing is the US, and the third thing is the Holocaust. Guilt. Do you see Germany? Germany sold us the submarines. The US, they let us steal uranium. You go to the UN, to the NPT, to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and you hear the US delegation reading their statements, and when they talk about Israel, you see paragraphs that you know from the language was written by Israelis.
So Israel has a special treatment?
Yes, we're a special case.
Yoshi Melman is known as an investigative journalist, specialized in intelligence and strategic affairs. He was described by WikiLeaks as an information mule who has exchanged tips with the Mossad. But in 2009, Melman uncovered a terrible secret about Dimona. Workers at the nuclear reactor facility were made to volunteer to drink uranium in 1998 as part of an experiment.
The workers themselves already cannot say anything. They have so many contracts saying that they cannot say. The question is the family. So usually in order for them to get compensation, the families also have to say they will not sue, they will not say, they will not speak to the media, and so on. We know only when they have settlements, when the court say settlement, that they give some money, but we don't know how much usually, and we don't know how many, and we don't know what condition. And also their doctors are only doctors that work with the commission.
I mean, if you only have a nuclear reactor that is making energy like Chernobyl or Fukushima, that's just one thing. You have lots of possibilities for accidents, but if you've got added to that, you've got uranium enrichment, you've got plutonium reprocessing, and you have actually the making of the warheads, then you have, you know, many more possibilities. Have there already been accidents? There's been some rumors and speculation that in 1966 there was a criticality accident at Dimona. We don't know what's been happening in that plant, and actually, it seems that there's probably more secrecy than there was in the Soviet Union, because quite quickly after the Chernobyl accident, it was actually said that there had been the accident. So I think Israel is better to compare on the level of secrecy about a nuclear program with perhaps North Korea, because we know nothing about their program either. We do know that they have one, and at least North Korea is making claims that it has nuclear weapons, whereas Israel is pretending that it doesn't. So I'm not trying to say that there will be worse or better, but there are many more possibilities, so the risk is definitely higher.
Our next stop in search of answers about the Israeli nuclear program and its secrets is a Palestinian village. Dahria, very close to Dimona, and a military field where Israel might be burying nuclear waste from Dimona. In Dahria, a Palestinian doctor struggles to keep Dimona's victims alive. Cesium is not present in nature and can only be found in areas where a nuclear disaster or test takes place.
We know how cesium works on the body because of Chernobyl and Fukushima. Both of those accidents showed us a lot of about how cesium actually affects human health, and that there are claims that there has been a study that has found cesium in the region, and cesium is an indication that something has happened with a nuclear activity. It most likely would be, depending on the amount of it, would be from a nuclear accident, or it could be from leaking radioactive waste.
In some areas of Palestine, the presence of cesium is at the same levels as in Chernobyl or Fukushima, places where the worst nuclear accidents took place.
It's a radioactive isotope. It has a half-life of 30.2 years, and it acts like potassium or like salt. It's water-soluble, so it can spread very quickly through the body, and it tends to concentrate then in muscle tissue. You also have muscles in certain organs like heart and stomach and intestines, so that's where often cesium will end up. And at that point, it starts then to mutate the cells within those muscles, and you end up with cancer of the colon, cancer of the stomach, of the lungs sometimes, and it can lead to heart disruption.
There are many rumors about where they bury the waste, but my, and not just my estimations, are that all the materials are buried in the area surrounding the reactor. And the reason is that these materials are secret. They don't want people to go and take land samples or go with Geiger.
The Geiger counter is an electronic device that measures the level of radioactivity. These devices are allowed for use everywhere in the world. It is sold everywhere, even online, but not in Israel. Despite claiming to be democratic, Israelis cannot buy a Geiger counter inside Israel.
One of the major problems that we have, again, it goes back to the secrecy problem, is that we can't even measure the amount of radiation in the area, because that's not allowed. And the Israeli law even says that if you take a Geiger counter into the area around Dimona and measure the radioactivity, you could be then sentenced to 15 years in prison. So nobody's going to do that. I know people even thought about doing it, but they didn't. It's certainly very risky to try to do any research on this at all, which is why number one problem is to get rid of the secrecy.
What is the security of Israel, and why the security of Israel is so different than the security of the people that live in Israel. And we hear rumors about buildings where the levels of cancer is unbelievable. And when we wanted to ask doctors, we also didn't get any answers. And one of funny or sad answer we got was that we cannot measure the amount of cancer, radiation-related cancer in Israel, because we had so many people coming from Chernobyl, from Kiev, and that changed the numbers. So that was one answer we got. And of course, this is not a serious answer. People in Dimona are not rich, most of them. If they were rich people, they wouldn't live next to a reactor, I guess. They wouldn't be depending on this reactor for their livelihood. A few years ago, they all got iodine pills that were very old iodine pills, and that was it. And they're not asking, and that's the problem, that they're more afraid to talk about it than the radiation.
But there are more cases around Palestine. In a small village lost in Al-Khalil Hills,